Go Loud.
Hi all, it's Kira here, and before we get going today, just wanted to say that we did not release an episode of the podcast last week because my own sister Dara passed away and it just didn't feel right. So that is why we weren't here last week, and I'd also like to thank you all for the kindness and the support I've received from so many of you since then. It's been very much appreciated. Now, on with today's episode.
Hello and welcome back to this episode of They Mess You Up with myself, Dr. Richard Hogan.
And myself, Dr. Kira Kelly.
Today, Kira, we're going to talk about a very pressing issue. I think an issue that's all over the media at the moment, and that is technology, technology bans, the impact of technology on our children, and how do we as parents get our arms around this thing?
Yeah, and I think hugely topical, but it must surely be nowadays one of the biggest challenges.
Yeah.
That parents have. And I would actually go as far as to say it's so big that lots of parents have given up on it entirely.
Well, I think there's a whole generation of anyone born in the early 2000s, there's a whole generation of children that have just gone through this thing absolutely without any legislation, without any laws, with parents probably a bit supine on this, and fingers crossed this all works out and we don't understand this technology lark. And I think there's a whole generation gone through. And I think the data on Gen Zs is particularly striking at the moment. So we just have a look at, what is this thing, technology?
You've just described me, supine,
yeah.
Not tech savvy. I'm a bit of a Luddite when it comes to tech. I am the parent. And I say this with no sense of
bravado or anything.
But I'm the parent that goes, oh God, well, it's one of you turn on the television. It's become so bloody complicated. Four remote controls and all this. You know, is it apps? Is it Sky? What are we doing? So I'm not tech savvy.
So you literally like saw this thing happen in front of your eyes.
And my first child was born in the year 2000. And my last child is now 16,
right,
and has just missed any ban or any major verification that's going to happen. So I parented four kids the whole way through that. And I was,
fingers crossed kind of thing?
No, I was always behind the curve. I was always fingers crossed. I was a bit of an ostrich.
Yeah.
I was literally hoping for the best parent because my kids are okay.
Yeah.
But that's by accident as much by design.
Well,
maybe bolstering them in other ways. Yeah. But I never really got to grips with the tech.
When we have a fear, when we don't feel like we know something, we have two responses. We try to control it. We avoid it. And I think most parents just avoid it and say, look, hopefully this thing works out. Everything's going to be okay. They're upstairs. I think that's mainly the mentality for a long time. They're upstairs. I know where they are. They're safe enough. They can't get into much trouble there. And I suppose all the research and all the data has shown us.
We learn fears over time and we pass them down. So for years, parents had been afraid of the man in the white van giving puppies and candy and sweets out the back of it. That barely exists.
No.
But we don't let them walk to the shops because of it. But instead, we leave them upstairs in their bedroom with their phone, with porn, hazardous sort of...
algorithms content. Feeding them stuff.
Yeah. Algorithms feeding them eating disorder stuff, self-harm stuff, mentally destabilizing stuff.
Suicidal ideation.
Cyberbullying. We haven't learnt the new danger and we're still focused on a danger that is...
You know, absolutely. As I analyse it, and I'm really, in this space a lot and talking about this space, and I analyse and I was thinking, well, what happened to parents so that they became more comfortable with their child being upstairs? And I always thought, things like, Jamie Bulger, Madeleine McCann, Jessica and Holly Wells. We were kids, parents, we were younger people growing up at that time with Jamie Bulger.
Yeah.
So that got into our soul. And then when our kids said to us at 6 or 7 they wanted to walk to the shop, we said, no, we'll go with them, because that lightning, as you described, those shadowy people that have always been in our society.
Stranger
danger. The stranger, that lightning, that abhorrent lightning that strikes now and again, we felt, we got to get our hands around that. And so when our kids stayed in the bedroom, we're thinking, safe.
And
safe.
Even though we walked the shops at 6 and 7.
Oh, Jesus.
With an older sibling or an older pal or whatever it was, and your parents didn't know where you were half the time. And we know that we mostly did perfectly well with that. We didn't pass that on to our kids. And I think you're
exactly overcorrected it, you see.
Yeah, we did.
We overcorrected that.
We cotton-wooled them, but we exposed them to other things.
And then we have huge levels of anxiety, which we'll come back to in a different podcast. And all of that cotton-wool stuff, all of that causing of childhood, it leads to a child not having any experiences. And the best way to an antidote to anxiety is experience and overcoming stuff.
And I do think that that we touched on that just as we started talking on this, when it's too big, the problem, as you say, you either, you have two approaches, but one of them is avoidance.
Avoidance.
There's a brilliant ad, do you remember it, on German TV, I think it was, years ago. It was about identifying the dangers to your kids from online stuff to parents.
Yeah.
And the ad was, there was a parent downstairs in the living room, there was a knock on the front door, and opened the door, and like scantily clad women started walking up the stairs to the children's bedroom, and the parent was like, whatever, close the door, and then opened the door again, and someone really violent came in,
all of that stuff,
and then opened the door again, and kind of a guy who looked like a complete pervert, and the idea was, look who you're actually letting into your home to your children when they're upstairs on their phones. If we saw our children interacting with those people out in the real world, we would step in.
But this is Ciara.
We're not stepping in.
This is the thing.
And it's because we're overwhelmed and we don't have the skills.
Yes. And I think we have such strong human rights for children in the real world. There are rights for children online. The right to, you know, accurate information. Think about that. The right to be safe. You know what I mean? These are really important rights that are online that are just absolutely annihilated every second of the day of online. And you saw recently there, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the media. I'm sure you're on your hard shoulder program there, you were talking about it. You know, X not turning up for the meeting there with the Oireachtas meeting, and everyone's giving out about X. I'm just saying, when I'm looking at that, I'm like, they're just more transparent. They're just been more real than the other people who turned up.
Well, TikTok, for example, when they were asked how long, you know, if somebody reports harmful content to you, how long does it take for you to take that down? And they said, well, we respond between zero minutes and 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyone who uses,
semantically, their way out of it.
Yeah, exactly that. And the truth of it is that anyone who is engaged in any of these platforms, and if you've ever, and I have reported things the odd time, I kind of gave up on it nearly.
Yeah, because it goes
almost
nowhere.
Pointless. But you no more get a response in an hour or two or whatever.
Sure, Simon Harris himself, when he was Taoiseach, had received incredible harmful content.
Awful.
And he couldn't get it down. Imagine what chance Sandra has at 15 in some school, you know what I mean? And so if the Taoiseach of the country, the head of the country can't get stuff taken down. And I think that Oireachtas meeting is really important, a seminal moment in our history, because as a state, I think the politicians were pretty decent there. They're pushing them and all the rest of it. But I just think the fact when they asked them, how many under 16-year-olds do you have on your platforms? They asked them that question and they said, we're not telling you. Now, there you go, right? They said, we can't tell you. It's not like we can't tell you. Of course they know. We won't tell you because we know that those figures are astronomically large, and that's when we make
a
revenue.
And that's going to look really bad
for us. And we're not telling you. Imagine going in front of the government at some shop selling something in Grafton Street, a head shop or whatever it was, and they said, how many customers do you have? We're not telling you. You know, we'd close them down immediately.
Exactly. It does speak to a degree of arrogance that they have,
but the arrogance
comes from a place of power.
Power, exactly. They know
they are hard to regulate because they are important industries.
Yeah, yeah. They make huge money.
Yes,
they make the size of a small gross national product.
They have influence, they have power, and they have money, and so they are hard to put manners on.
They are, but they're making all that money comes from us. You know, you know what I mean? We can't forget that. All that revenue is from us, and the government should not be cowed by these guys. You know what I mean? Big tech, there should be it drives me absolutely insane. And I get asked this question all the time. Because Australia has done their ban recently, and France is moving the same. England is going to move the same. I hear Simon Harris talking about a ban and all that, and people ask me, what do you think? Is a ban a good idea? And what do you think, first of all, before I get into what my
I would love there to be a ban.
Yeah.
I would love there to be a ban. And by the way, people have said to me, yeah, but how would you enforce it? They'll get around it. And I say, whoa, whoa, whoa. We don't sell alcohol to under 18s.
No.
Now, if you're telling me that no one ever gets around that.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course they do. But we still have the law, and we still have that as a line in the sand.
Yeah, but everyone said seatbelts. You'll never get Irish people to wear seatbelts.
And we have rules around drugs. We have rules around driving. We have rules around alcohol. We have rules that are age related, left, right and centre.
Yeah.
Are they sometimes subverted? Yes, they are. But that doesn't undermine
that doesn't mean we stop
the value
yeah, exactly.
isn't there to exactly. have the rules. And once you have the rules, you can enforce them to some extent, exactly. And you can put some restrictions on things. And I still think that's very important.
This is the way when I look at this, right, and I get asked this question all the time, what do you think about a ban, or what do you think about this or that? And I'd say, okay, this is the way I imagine it in my mind. Let's imagine there's a toxic sewer that our children have to navigate every day, right, to get to school or whatever. There's a toxic sewer that they go through. And you're asking me, well, should we stop kids from 0 to 16 going through that toxic sewer to get to school? I'd say, yeah, that's decent enough. But then when they're 16, they have to go through that toxic sewer anyway. And you're kind of going, okay, so they have to navigate it at 16. So do you think we should ban it for those younger ages? I'd say, yeah, I think we should ban it for those ages. What about the 16-year-olds? I'd say, yeah, no, so they're going to go through it anyway. And so if you come to me and say, well, what do you think the answer is? I think it's so fucking obvious. You clean the sewer. And so that a child can go through it and a 16-year-old can go through it. So you're not banning it. It's clean, right? So it's not toxic. And so that you can enjoy walking through in your little shortcut to school, and it's not toxic, and it's simple to clean it. It is such
is
a simple.
Yeah, it is. This is where I'm not sure I agree with you fully. Tell me how you think we can clean it simply.
Well, first of all, you have to, like, this is the thing here. This is the simplicity of that. First of all, you have to make these platforms publishers. Because they are publishers. They're publishing stuff. It's like if I had a billboard in town and I was putting up, Ciara Kelly is the biggest blah, blah, blah on my billboard.
Yeah.
I'd have to take responsibility for it. And now I have a billboard that the world sees, and I'm just letting people come along and write it and do whatever they want. And I'm saying, well, it's nothing to do with me. People can write what they want. It's rubbish. So you have to there has to be accountability. But here's the thing where I would clean it up, right? About 80% of it is not bad. And then there's 20%. Awful, awful, awful suicide ideation. Everything in there that's awful. I would, first of all, make them responsible for it. And then second of all, when they break it, because they're like currently a fine to X is like, a fine to X.
A drop in the bucket.
They have a decide and they don't give a shite, right? So a fine to X makes no difference. Fining Elon Musk, a trillionaire, makes no difference. He's got that money set aside. It's absolutely none. So I would say you shut the platform down until the platform is, every time the platform produces something that's toxic, you shut it down.
Okay. There's a couple of arguments here. And by the way, I don't fundamentally disagree with you. I think something needs to be done. I think it's like the Wild West, and I think it is lawless, and just like the Wild West, laws had to be put on it.
Absolutely.
Eventually.
And bring it into civilization.
So I do think that. But I think a couple of things is, making them a publisher, it seems like a great idea. But the issue about making them a publisher is the sheer volume and speed with which people post.
Yeah.
So that's problematic.
With AI, we have the tools, you see. No, honestly, we have the tools.
That's actually a good point, because AI moves very quickly and could screen things for defamation.
Absolutely.
Or screen for whatever.
Very quickly.
So that is possible. But the volume and the speed of the internet is part of the issue around making them a publisher. And the other thing is, and it is in the back of my libertarian mind, that when we police this too much, an authoritarian state or a nefarious kind of a state can control information access to information and free speech. And I know lots of the people who defend free speech are buffoons who want to be racist and objectionable.
Of course.
I am neither of those things. But I still believe fundamentally in the value of free speech, because that allows, when necessary, to preach truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
And we need that. And it seems to me the people who are always anti-free speech are those in power. Like, when the Liberals are in power, they want to sort of sanction conservative speech. Mm-hmm. When the Conservatives and the religious orthodoxy and all that were in power, and I mean hegemonic power. When they were in power, they wanted to sort of police liberal speech. So whoever is in charge likes to control what the dissenters say. We need dissenters to be allowed to speak
we do.
At times.
Absolutely.
And so I believe fundamentally in the principle of free speech, and not, as I say, because I want to spout racist nonsense or anything like that. Not for those reasons, but because without it, the people are losing a degree of power that
truth.
They need
yeah, yeah.
and truth that they need. So So I see that as an issue too.
No, I know, and I'm a big defender of free speech because I think currently any attack on it, you know, has to go through a far more rigorous examination than, you know, someone defending free speech has to make a much bigger argument than someone attacking it.
One person's hate speech is another person's joke.
Yeah, well,
here's
my, like, I get what you're saying. That is a really complicated issue,
yeah,
and all the rest
really
of it. It's really complicated. But I'm thinking, like, you know, okay, I hear what you're saying there, and then that's the state's control over the information that goes onto these machines and into our children's lives. But I'm talking about pornography, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm talking about
fair.
Really, really damaging stuff here for a child. I'm talking about a child, you know, I did a primetime investigation there last year. It was called 13 on TikTok, and we set up 3 phones and we just watched the phones go. We didn't like anything, didn't do anything like that, and just watched how the algorithm fed stuff to a teenage girl's mind, 13-year-old. And in one of the videos they said, "My mom will finally know how she's hurt me when I'm dead." Now that's suggesting suicide to a vulnerable kid.
Yeah.
Right? And not every kid who consumed that, if I was a 13-year-old, I wouldn't have thought about suicide. But if you're vulnerable, you know, if you've got something really complicated going on in your life and
you're so young and you're so immature.
Young and you don't understand the finality of a decision like that, you know, you don't understand the absoluteness of something like that, and you're thinking, oh, the funeral might be kind of cool and, you know, there'll be loads of people there, and they're
a
showing you
solution to a temporary
but the algorithm is showing you a funeral, and some of the algorithms were showing them a very with all the favourite songs being played and all this. You're kind of going, to a child that is particularly heinous, and I'm like, that has to stop as a matter of emergency.
And there's no justification for free speech
there in that, you know what I mean?
I fully agree,
and I get your point, because it's a very intellectual point. We have to think about that, obviously, but we're trying to make sure that our children don't get harmed, you know. It's that first thing about a child. I worked in schools where a senior infant had consumed hardcore extreme material, and pornography today is incestuous. It's all about stepsister, stepbrother, stepmother,
it's also violent, choking, slapping, humiliation, it's all of that. It's not the porn as people might remember from their youth.
No, it's not the Euro trash, you know, remember that stuff? And it's like, Jesus, it's not that at all. And I'm not a prude. It's that I work with it so much. And it's dark. And I work with teenage girls. And I'm sitting there and they're telling me what their boyfriend asked them for, a 15-year-old boy. And I'm thinking, what a fucking tragedy we got here. Yeah. That a boy would think that's okay. And that a girl who's like likes her boyfriend thinks that that's what she has to do to make him feel good.
If you're watching that kind of hardcore dark porn at a formative... We refine our sexual tastes throughout our lives.
Yeah,
we hone
absolutely.
Them. We It's like when you're a kid, you don't like eating olives.
Yeah.
You might be eating them in your 40s.
I'm a big fan of the olive.
Do you know what I mean? So you refine your
taste. Yeah.
That happens.
Your taste, no.
That, you know, I think it's fair to say that happens sexually too. And if what you're consuming is dark and humiliation and you're becoming titillated and you're becoming aroused from that, that feeds
It's rewiring
in.
Your chemistry.
Exactly that. There was a time when sexual relationships between young people, which have always existed, had an innocence to them.
Mm.
And I don't mean they weren't necessarily having sex.
But there was an innocence.
Exploratory.
Yeah, which adolescence should be.
Yes, exactly.
This is my point. I'm not a prude. I'm saying, like, adolescence is a time of exploration.
Yes.
That's the way the adolescent brain develops a certain way. It's about sexual identity.
And you're finding your own taste that way.
Yes, but that discovery.
And exactly. But you're not
that should be exciting.
Fed it by somebody else.
Yeah, but that should be exciting. That shouldn't lead you down into a dopamine hell of, like, consent, because dopamine is a really important part of this. And so if I'm 8 or 9 and my cousin comes in and shows me a hardcore image and I get, like, you know, really excited by that, and then I go into this dark place. Memory, dopamine is a part of your memory production, and so when you, it's from evolution, so when I open the fridge, you know, you find food, dopamine fires to tell you that's where you go for food. And if I get sexually aroused and dopamine fires, it says that's where you go to get to satisfy your arousal.
Yeah.
And then you need more dopamine, and these guys who make it know that, and they make it more taboo. Taboo fires dopamine.
Yeah, and they 100% know that. And then you are left in a situation where we have young men and adolescent boys who are now aroused by
dark stuff
and all of that. And that is going to be feeding into their relationships for the rest of their lives and changing fundamentally what should have been a beautiful thing, you know, a warm...
Connecting. The start of healing.
Sexual.
Everything
thing,
that it is.
Because that's what sex should be. Into something that is...
Secretive.
Yeah.
Seedy.
Covert,
yeah.
All of that. Furtive.
Yeah.
But also even... That kind of they don't even want normal sex. They actually maybe withdraw from normal sex, as we know, and masturbate to porn instead.
Absolutely. And then seek it out. Seek out
all of this. So we know the effects of stuff. So I'm not arguing that at all. I'm not arguing the ban either. I wish my children had been better protected, both by the state and the environment and legislation and the world we live in, and by me, because I've held up my hand and gone, I don't think I got this right at all. I would be 100% confident that, don't know about my daughter because I don't know whether she would or wouldn't have looked at it, but I am 100% confident that I have three sons and that they would have all seen porn young age.
But whether you want to, Kira, or not, this is the terrible thing. Whether you want or not, everyone's consumed it. I have a 15-year-old daughter, an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old, and so those younger ones have not gone anywhere near this stuff yet, you know. But I know for fact, what?
Thank God. I say thank God I'm an atheist,
I know what you mean, thankfully, But like, this is where I get really frustrated about it, because I have some 18 teenagers ringing my clinic, asking my secretary, can I ring them? I know what it's about. Then they won't leave their names and they just leave their number. And I'll ring them and say, how are you getting on? This is like once a month at least. And they'll talk to me about what's happened in their life and that they've been caught in pornography since they're 8 years of age and that they're with a girlfriend and it's absolutely destructive. They don't know what to do with themselves. They don't know how to be intimate with somebody. They don't know what to do. And I'm dealing with that from 15 years of age right up. And it drives me absolutely.
15 years of age, it's happening younger, but it's a 15 your age that they're actually
explore.
I need help with.
They're in a relationship and they know that it's not. They can't do anything. They don't know what to do because they're stuck in this other thing. And I find Kamashunaman, to be honest, I don't know how you feel about it.
Lay it out.
I get so frustrated with it. And I just kind of, I'm wondering, is it the government setting up a kind of a whipping boy so that they can go, it's not us, it's them over there. We've given them the full powers to do this thing. So don't be looking at us. Kamashunaman.
There is a reason we have so many NGOs.
Yeah.
There is a reason that we spend, I think it's £1 billion roughly on the thousands of NGOs that we have. A lot of people say that's very wasteful. Why are we spending all this money on bureaucracy largely? Mm-hmm. But you're right. Some of it gives the government an excuse to say we've done something and we have a different
body
that isn't us. Yeah. Who's in charge of all this stuff over here?
Set up the body and they're the ones looking after it. And remember, like 2 years ago, the head of Commission Amman said that they're not prescriptive in their legislation. I was like, what the fuck does that mean? You're setting up laws and they're not prescriptive.
I don't even know what that means.
Exactly.
Does it mean anything?
It means basically, like if you were setting up a law about seatbelts, that you'd say, would you mind wearing a seatbelt? Would you mind not taking alcohol at 12? But if you do, okay. But would you mind not doing that?
Well, if it's not prescriptive, it's not really a law.
It's nothing.
It's a suggestion.
But this is my point. It's a suggestion. And I've been around these meetings, you know what I mean? And I see, you know, when Meta come in, they're sitting there with their matcha, whatever, and they're thinking, you know, I'll report back.
Acai bowls.
I go, acai bowls, kiss my acai bowls, and they're going back to fucking San Diego going, nothing here to be worried about. Yeah. And let's make it. Why don't, because you know, Micheál Martin brought in the smoking ban. He's the man here. He brought in NEPs. He's the man to be able to kind of go, enough is enough. Let's do this. And I've interviewed him a couple of times. I hear that he's interested in doing that, and he talks about wanting to do that. Why don't we do that? Don't blame Europe and don't blame Commissioner Mann. Have some feckin' teeth and protect our children.
Well, just a mic drop moment, and I think you're right. But part of me does wonder, are the members of Kamashuna Man a bit like me? They're probably similar age, they're probably similar profile.
Very good point.
Do we not need engineers, software engineers and all the people who understand the nitty gritty about how to, because it's like we're talking philosophically about a practical issue.
Do you either want to do it or you don't, Kira.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I hear what you're saying.
I have been in with Kamashuna Man and I've talked to them. I think one of the reasons why they mightn't, truthfully, is foreign direct investment.
Yeah.
It is
probably
huge amounts of money, the huge amounts of corporate tax into this country every year off the back of American pharma and American tech.
Yeah, you're right. That's it.
And
that's
American tech is not quite as big here as American pharma, but it's a huge part of our industry. Pays us a fortune. We have the Apples and the Intels and they have a huge value. And they do have a value, by the way. I'm not kicking them on that level. They have jobs and they have corporate tax receipts, and they are massively important to this country, because those corporate tax receipts, we can give out about America all we want. We can give out about capitalism all we want. We can give out about all of that stuff all we want, but it's nonsense, because that money keeps the lights on in our hospitals and our schools and you know, and but, pays for our road and does all sorts of things.
But you see, this is my, you're absolutely right, but I think we need a, like a little shift in cognition around this. You can make all that money and it can be safe. You know, it's like, you know, when you go to some works and they say, it's been 130 days since we've had an accident here. You know what I mean?
Like,
we need to set tech up like that, to think like that, like, parents want their children. They don't want them off. They want them to be able to enjoy technology. I'm not trying to force an 80s childhood.
A horrendous thought there. I was saying, but surely then, like, if we can do it and it's safe and they can still make money, why? Why wouldn't they want to do that? And then I'm suddenly thinking of people, to, you know, the other conversation that's going on globally now is the Epstein file, that the world is run by a cabal of paedophile billionaires who maybe don't want to clean the sewer because they actually like the sewer themselves. You read the Epstein files, any of them, if you actually go and look on the Department of Justice website, they're sickening, a lot of them. They're actually sickening.
It's beyond, it's,
and these are people who are
evil.
Elite.
I mean, it's evil. Like,
yeah, you know, but they are elite in our society. They are elite in our world.
If you look at the IWF, the International Watch Foundation, you know, they all look at all the kind of stuff. They found out of 270,000 images that were sexual, they were 92% of those were self-generated and they were between the ages of 8 and 12. And so what that foundation is showing us, that the Internet Watch Foundation is showing us, that children are being sexualized earlier and earlier at 8 and taking selfies
at 8
sexually.
Their teeth are falling out.
Exactly.
They
have an 8-year-old at home. The innocence there stolen, and that doesn't come back.
This conversation is becoming worse and worse because it's so bleak. What can we do as parents, do we think?
Okay, so again, going back to the dark sewer, toxic sewer, it's like, okay, as parents, we can protect our children from going through it and we can help them with it, right? But we do need robust legislation to kind of like clean that sewer out properly and so that they can go on. Okay, the first thing I would say is a policy in the family is such an important thing, Kira. A tech policy in the family,
and
that
by
everybody
that do you
does.
Mean the phones aren't in the rooms. You give up your phone at a certain time
of
the day.
Yes, exactly.
You're only on it a certain amount.
Okay,
and
go on.
I think you're right.
It's very hard to roll back.
I was about to say. Yeah. What do you say to the parent whose that ship has already
Can we do that? I'll do that next, because that's a really important, because that's a rowing back pit, and that's a really important question. So for those who are listening and have younger kids, and they're fearful of like technology and all the rest of it, I would say have a policy, because children kind of accept the reality they're born into and all the rest of it, and have that policy. I did it with my own daughter. She pushed back, and then just gave up pushing back. 5 to 7, no phone. None of us have a phone 5 to 7. That's dinner, it's homework, it's chatting. And if you want to talk about how do you build your child's resilience, it's in those moments.
I want you to be my dad.
Well, my daughter said to me in sixth class, it was funny, she said, Dad, it's awful being your daughter. And I said, why is that? And then she said, a girl came up to me today in the yard and said, it's your dad's fault, I don't have a smartphone. And I said, well, now you're not alone. Now you've got two of you together to hang around.
I love the lack of sympathy around that. Yeah. Great.
Now you're not alone.
You.
She was telling me she was the only one on her phone and all the rest. But have
they
a pop.
They all tell us they're the only one.
It's my dad, my friend's dad's much nicer than you. It's all that persuasive stuff. But so 5 to 7, you know, have that policy. After 9 o'clock, down in the kitchen, all phones down in the kitchen. And so, like, I want her to be on her phone.
You say, here's another question that undermines parenting.
Yeah.
When you say all phones, do you mean your own as well?
Yes.
You see,
that's it.
That's where
that's the policy. It's a tech policy.
Compromised.
Yeah, no.
Too, because I don't want to give my phone back.
Yeah, well, you
so that's
should.
Part. Yeah, but I'm not denying I should.
Yeah, yeah.
Parents are getting into an area where they feel ambivalent because they don't want to give up their phones.
And teenagers have a heightened sense of hypocrisy. And the amount of teenagers who sit with me next to their dad and say, he says to me, you know, get off the phone, and he's scrolling Instagram, and the dad would say, well, I'm on my emails. He's like, I see you on your TikTok.
Yeah.
You're full of it.
I see you on
you know what I mean?
TikTok.
But that's it's true. And so it's like, you know, you have to have a really good policy that allows for your child to be on the
so
device.
You're setting
I'm not
the same
against
standard
technology.
For yourself that
yes.
you're setting for your children.
Exactly. So it's not a tech punishment. It's not a policy that punishes a child. It's a family policy, the culture that we live by.
Here's the thing, because modernity has, I sound like an old git now, but modernity has changed. There was a time when people believed in holding themselves to standards and that sort of almost formal
modeling
and all that.
Most important thing you do as a parent.
I think that's
gone. I think you're
largely
right.
Gone. So I think that you saying, I will hold myself to the same standards I will expect from you, which we probably do as parents in other areas.
Yeah.
Like, we don't, I would say to my child, don't litter. I don't litter. Why would you litter?
Yeah, exactly.
I would say to
you're
my
modeling.
Child, recycle.
Exactly.
I recycle.
Yes.
You recycle. You know, things like that.
Yes, exactly.
Phones, this is another reason. I said
because
that
we're also addicted
avoid
to them.
It and we're out of our depth and all that. But this is the problem that parents are compromised on, because they don't
also
want to hold themselves to what they are. So, and then
exactly.
We're all in it together now.
But that's exactly it.
Drowning.
And if, but yeah, and then we're not together. And the question I'd say to parents, listen to this now. What, your kids will move out and they will go off into their lives like we did, and they will set their own stories together and they will have their own relationships, and more than likely they have their own kids and all that. How do you want them to reflect on the time with you and your partner, or you, if you're a single parent, living with you? What do you want them to say? It was completely and utterly separated, isolated and lonely? Or do you want to say that there was great moments there together? Of course, we fought like every other family, but there were moments we were connected, which was dinner. Don't give up on that, because parents are always asking me about what makes a resilient child in this age of technology. Being together, listen to your child talk, allowing them to tell you about their day, that's where resilience comes from. They feel like they matter. They feel like they're a part of something where they can express themselves. Yeah. Technology is stealing that, you know what I mean? We have to say, well, no, that's our parent. The government can't do that for us in the house. We have to do that stuff ourselves.
Is there a bit of a cop-out wanting the government to do all of these things and us being unwilling to do simple things like you've just described there ourselves?
We have to do those simple things. That's what I'm always saying, that we can't expect the government to parent our children. We have to do those. We do expect the government to bring in legislation to protect our children, but we have to parent them, and we have to not be their best friend, and we have to be the person that says, no, get off that. Because my daughter, you know, 5 to 7, when I come up and say, phone, I can still 15, I get an all eye roll and all the rest of it, but it doesn't bother me. And I say, you know, I get that.
But I think one thing that we forget is one of the good things that you can have in a parent-child relationship is respect.
Yes.
And your daughter might roll her eyes at you, but she still hands you the phone.
I
and there's a reason
phone.
Why she hands you the phone, and that is respect.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some of that respect comes from the boundaries that you are imposing on her. Because kids want us to draw a line in the sand, and they might step over it a little bit, but they'll still step over it in relation to wherever it is. Do you know what
You're
I mean?
Absolutely right.
So we've anchored them, or we've tethered them in some way.
No, it's such a good point. And what I say to parents there about that is, I never use the phone as a parenting device. I never take the phone off her if she annoys me, because by God, it will modify her behavior very quickly. If I say, give me the phone, she'll, oh, sorry, Dad. She won't be sorry. She just wants her social network not to be cut off. And so don't do that, because if there's an issue, you want them to come and talk to you. You want them to be able to connect with you.
Lastly, if somebody was listening to this now and was going to take, and I'm talking about a parent rather than a policymaker, we're going to take one step. Is that one step, do you think, that tech policy for the home, is there a baby step there for people who actually are addicted to phones themselves and kind of go, I don't think I can do that? Is there something smaller?
Yeah, absolutely.
But impactful, do you think, Richard?
Yeah, 100%. And I say this to parents every time I talk to them. I'm talking to them every night. I'd say, you know, because they'd say to me, I've had no policy up to now. Right? And so what do I do? And let's say, well,
the road back is so hard.
It's very hard. Too much difference is too much. You can't bring in all these rules in one go, because it just will fall apart. I'd say pick one thing you think you can actually implement. And if you're asking me, what would be the really important thing for parents to implement in the, I'd say get the phone out of the bedroom. That's a very good first start at nighttime. That's a very, because nothing good happens on that phone after 9 o'clock, half nine.
No,
and get it out of the bedroom.
I'm not sure much happens good on that phone in that bedroom either.
Any time, to be honest. But get it out of the bedroom, because that's a time of sleep and that's a time of rest. Get it out of the bedroom. If you could get that one done, and the way I would bring it in is say, look, we're all going to do this for 2 weeks. We're all trialing this. But I read this. And it's not about you, you know what I mean? I read this. I'm going to do this. Let's give it a go for 2 weeks and see how we get on. I guarantee you that child at the end of those 2 weeks will be more rested and have more sleep.
Sleeping better.
Yeah.
All right.
Look. Better mood.
Okay, I might try that one myself, because I do know that app.
The last thing you should do is scroll that phone, Ciara Kelly.
I know. So
you went from the hard shoulder. You're like, oh, shit.
And that's the thing as well, and no different to a teenager. I could be scrolling my phone
at night.
I'll see someone say something about me.
Yeah.
And it's not always good. Well, and then you're left with that. Do you know what I mean?
Under one of her posts there, they all wanted to maybe go on a date with Shakira.
That was actually really weird.
That's funny. I was like, what kind of fans have you got?
You know what I actually thought?
They were fighting about who was going to date you.
You know what I actually thought?
Yeah.
I hoped you didn't see that, because I saw it and I was like, oh.
I was like choking on a sandwich, really laughing, going, you were going, what the hell?
If they only knew her. That is our lot for this week on They Mess You Up. Please like and follow us wherever you get your pods. You can listen in, of course, and also on the Go Loud app. And if you follow us on Insta at They Mess You Up Pod, you can send us DMs, because we would love to hear from you.
You can ask Ciara a date.
About what you... I will not be answering those, but we would love to hear from you about what you would like us to talk about on the pod.